History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. One thing we've learned over the years is that they don't have to go untold. If we'll take the initiative to ask a few questions and take the time to patiently listen, there's really no limit to what we might learn. Our goal here is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And yes, along the way, we are not only educated, we're not only entertained, but we really can be inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. 78 years ago this week, the invasion of Sicily began. It's not something we hear about nearly as often as the invasion of Normandy, which took place nearly a year later, or some of those famous landings in the Pacific. But capturing Sicily was a very important step for the Allies in World War II, in part for the lessons learned and the roadmap it established for future operations. The code name was Operation Husky. And from July 9, 1943 till the middle of August, nearly 500,000 Allied troops from the U.S., the U.K., and Canada battled German and Italian forces for control of the island. More than 2,800 Americans gave their lives over those 6 weeks, and there were more than 7,000 additional casualties. The end result was the dethroning of a dictator in Benito Mussolini and an open door for the invasion of mainland Italy that would commence just 2 weeks after Sicily was secured. Today we're going to learn about what happened at Sicily through the memories of five different men who were there 78 years ago. They came from five different states: Michigan, Massachusetts, Colorado, South Dakota, and New York. Let's start with Jerry Countess, who grew up in Brooklyn, a recipient of the Silver Star and Purple Heart. Jerry was always convinced his closest call came on Sicily while serving with the famed 1st Infantry Division, the Big Red One. His book, Letters from the Battlefield in Love and War, centers around his lifelong connection to a nurse named Rachel.
We were close together for a year or two. She went to Brooklyn College at night, as I did. I lived on this side of town, and she lived over here. I drove my bicycle across town to her. We walked from there to back to her house, which was another mile or two, and we stayed out together until 12, 1 o'clock at night, and then I had a ride back by bike all the way across Brooklyn to the other side. But I didn't care. I was happy. I was also young.
Yeah.
My thighs were like that, solid iron. At any rate, we did that, and then when I got in the Army, she got word that she was accepted for the Barnett Memorial Hospital in New Jersey, Patterson, New Jersey. But when I heard that she had gotten into that school and I knew I was going overseas, I knew that if I didn't do something quick about seeing her, we weren't going to see each other, possibly never. So me and two other guys who were in the regular Army went AWOL on a Saturday morning. We got a train, which was a six-hour ride to New York. But we got a train. We went to New York. These two guys went out and had a great time for the weekend. I saw her. She said, oh, I had to go to the school where she was in Patterson, New Jersey. I went there. I found her. Everybody looked at me in an Army uniform. What the hell are you doing there? But I found her, and I proposed to her, and I said, okay, let's get married. We have a weekend. And she said, no, I don't want to be a widow before I'm a wife. She said, for me, marriage is something serious. I'm not going to do this for a one-night stand.
Mm-hmm.
I understood. I wasn't happy, but I understood what she said. I said, okay. And we kissed, and I got back into Manhattan. I got on the train at Penn Station, and I went back down to where it was. The train went down about 3 hours, no problem. And then suddenly the train stopped, was moved over onto a siding. Nobody knew why. We sat for over 2 hours until another train coming up from the south had to go past us, and they had to have the open road to go. Mm-hmm. So they went past us, and then we got back on. The train went back on the road. But I arrived back at Fort Lee, which is where I was at, 2 hours after Reveille in the morning.
Uh-oh.
That is precisely what. So I thought, well, you know, they won't let me take a weekend off, which is what one of the forms of punishment that they gave you. Well, you know, if you're sitting in an Army barracks and you couldn't go away for the weekend, it was no fun. So me and the other two guys went in. The two Army guys got 30 days. They couldn't leave the barracks. I got 30 days in jail.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what jail was, but it was just a small building. It wasn't a regular big jail. And you couldn't get out of the building. However, they gave you a job. You couldn't just sit in the jail. My job was to go out with the cleanup detail every morning. The truck went around. I picked up the full barrels of waste from every one of the barrels.
And they threw
them into the truck.
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was going to be terrible. But it turned out not to be quite so terrible because all of the dirty stuff was taken somewhere else. So all they had was mail. I went through the mail, and I was sitting in the back of the truck. I dumped it out on the ground, on the back of the truck, and I take up a letter and look at it, and almost all the letters were from females, all the letters to males, and some were pretty juicy. So I read them, and I would tell you, hey, listen to this one. You got to read this one. Three guys would come up and sit down in the truck while we were riding, and I would read some of that stuff. It became a lot of fun.
And here I'm thinking, okay, you went to go ask the woman you love to marry you. She said no. It cost you your spot in the quartermaster corps. It's going to end up putting you in the infantry on the front lines. But you're having fun while you're in jail.
So far, yeah.
All right.
Except after 2 weeks, suddenly I got pulled out of jail, put back in my barracks, and 3 days later they told me, goodbye, you're going in the army overseas. When we got on the boat, we were given guns. In basic training, we had been given 1908 Springfields.
Mm-hmm.
We did get to shoot 12 shots. That was the training with a gun.
That was the extent of your training, and now you're heading overseas with an infantry division.
When I got overseas, I didn't get a Springfield. We got the brand new M1s.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody told us anything about the guns, just here's your gun.
And you told me one of the reasons that you wrote this book, and this book, Letters from the Battlefield in Love and War, it's comprised of letters that you wrote to Ray, who you talked about, who you were in love with, who said she wouldn't marry you before you went overseas. And also to another friend of yours, and there are letters that were written to you as well. And it tells a lot of these stories, but you said one of the reasons you wrote it is you want people to know what it's really like out there. Not necessarily the guts and the glory and the combat, but the day after day of life that changes the way you see your existence.
Well, it was early on. Later on, I was able to write that because I knew, not exactly, but I had lived through the business of what it was like. The first thing you do when you stop walking, the absolute first thing you do, even if you only can stop for 2 or 3 hours, you dig a foxhole. Invariably, the Germans held a higher level, and you fought to take it. When you took it, then you went forward again. You're going down the mountain. You went up a one. They were higher. So they could see, not well, but they could see how many troops there were and what was going on. So if you stopped on a mountain ridge or you stopped in a low place, you were pretty sure that the Germans higher than you were watching you with glasses, telescopes. So you dug a foxhole. I was very lucky. I was short. I could dig a foxhole faster than the tall guys. We all carried the most important instrument, a shovel, about a foot and a half long, but it had a head about this big. The purpose of that shovel, as soon as you stopped, you reached behind you, uncorked it, and you started digging. If you were lucky, you were digging in sand. But in the mountains, you weren't digging in sand. So digging a foxhole was a very arduous thing.
But that could be the difference between life and death.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The purpose of a foxhole is to keep you below the level where shrapnel flying this way can't touch you. But if you were out of that foxhole, shrapnel flying at the height of a half a foot or whatever, you would be touched, seriously.
If I were to say, what was your closest call? Realizing that you're there in North Africa in 1943, then in Italy, all the way past Germany's surrender in Europe. So you're over there a long time. I'm sure you had a lot of close calls. What was the moment where you felt you came closest to not coming home and trying to track down that special lady again?
Something that happened when we were attacking the Germans in Sicily. I saved a good part of my company. It had been was not intentional. I didn't know I was going to be doing it. Sicily is a huge collection of mountains, one after another, every way you look. Half of my company went up to the top of a certain area. And my job at that time was, I wasn't a typical fighting soldier. I was like the runner.
Mm-hmm.
My job was, remember, we didn't have cell phones at that time. we had a phone that was carried on a thing like this, and it worked when you turned the handle. But the battery died quickly. Sometimes it died and you didn't even know it died. it didn't always work. And even when it worked, you weren't sure you were going to get battle headquarters. They went up there and they were doing their job, you know, fighting the enemy. And all of a sudden, the Germans had new recruitment or whatever. They were really pounding on these people. Unexpectedly, these guys didn't expect to have that many people up there. They were in serious trouble. I had gone up to tell the captain something or whatever that from here, and that's what happened. Oh, my God. Look, you could see stuff flying all over the place. He said, you got to go down and tell them. He said, otherwise, by half an hour from now, we're going to be dead. He said, go down. You're the runner. You know which way to go. You know where the group is. Go get them and tell them. So I ran down that mountain. I have to tell you, most of the time I wasn't running, I was flying. I jumped going down from one, maybe 20 feet, 15 feet down, landed, fell over, got up, and kept running. It was a nightmare.
With enemy fire coming in the whole time?
Coming in, but not specifically at me. It was coming all over the place.
Sure.
The real danger to that was I could have broken a leg or broken an ankle. That would have been put me into real problems.
Because then you wouldn't have been able to get out.
I wouldn't have been able to get out. And if they took over that, the captain and his crew up there, they were going to come down. And
yep.
Then I'd have been up the creek without a paddle.
Yeah.
But, you know, lives of 10, 15, 20 guys are up there. So I had to go. I went down that mountain. I would never do that again in my life. But I was young. I was full of energy and strong. And driven by the necessity, I was more frightened than if they were shooting at me specifically, just going down because I knew time was of the essence. Mm. I had to get down there as soon as I can, or if I got down a long time, they wouldn't be alive.
So you made it in time.
I made it in time. I got the guy, and they had a phone that was working, not well, but working. They notified the artillery.
Mm-hmm.
And the artillery started shooting up at there, and the guys got out. Most of them got out. A few were hurt or wounded, one or two were killed. But basically, most of them got out.
So you made it. You saved their lives in the process. You avoided your life being taken. And here's another thing. You getting hit and killed, obviously, is not the ending you're looking for. But your being captured could have been equivalent. I've heard a lot of stories from people who were captured by the Germans, if depending on where you were, if the Germans found out about your Jewish heritage, have been in the end for you.
Yeah, it might have. Absolutely. I'll tell you a story about being captured. This was when I first joined, and I really didn't know very much. Remember, I told you that there were 8 different marching commands. This was maybe 3 or 4 weeks after I joined. We came to a place with a couple of mountains like this. So they gave us the command to march in a straight line, one behind the other. One platoon, 38, 36 guys, 3 or 4 squads. I was in the second squad, and we started to go up the hill. The Germans did something very clever. They stayed on both sides of where we were marching.
Mm.
When we went up halfway up, they went in this way. What they did is made it impossible for the guys in the back to shoot them because our guys were in the front.
Mm-hmm.
The guys in the front couldn't shoot back. Of course, we were in the back. So these guys took the front group lock, stock, and barrel. They got them, and we couldn't shoot at them. They took them away. So we lost 15, 14, something number of guys like that.
So if you had been on that half of where the Germans came in?
I'd have been up the creek. At any rate, I just want to finish this story. A year and a half, 2 years later, the war ended. And I was one of the first guys to be picked to go back home because of the number of different points I had irrelevant. So I got back, and I got back on the boat, and there are a couple thousand guys on the boat, and we were very lucky. Instead of the terrible weather we had going back, this was July, the weather was beautiful, the ocean was flat, and so I got on the boat. There are a couple thousand guys in there. Nobody wanted to sleep below. It was impossible. But we stayed up on top of the boat all day. I got to the rail of the boat, and I see some people I know, and we're talking. And I turn around, and I see about 15 feet behind me, there's another small group of guys talking. There's one guy standing there looking at me. We went down, we had lunch, I came back up again, and I go back to the same place, and there's the same guy there, and he's still looking at me, and he smiles. I don't know exactly what he was aiming at, but I didn't say anything. He came over to me. He said, "Hello, Jerry." He says, "You don't remember me?" "No, I don't remember you." He says, "I was in your platoon." not in your squad, but in your platoon. That is, platoon's 48, 50 people, so four squads, maybe 12 in each one. Mm-hmm. He was in the squad immediately before me on that hill. He was two guys ahead of me, and the line went, the Germans went between us.
Wow.
He was taken to Germany, and he worked in a German factory for the almost a full 2 years making tanks.
Wow.
He says, you can be sure that a lot of those tanks had deficiencies.
Uh-huh. He sabotaged
But them. That's where he was. So, yeah, he and a couple of other people obviously did that. But he spent the entire time that we went through all this crazy stuff, he was in a factory, getting up in the morning, working in the factory all day at night. And I asked him, I said, would you rather have been with us in the instead of in the factory? He said, no.
Uh-huh.
I understand. But what a coincidence, you know.
Yeah, and I guess that's a, hey, that could have been me moment.
If they'd have come up a little further, I was two guys away from him.
Mm-hmm. And you were helpless, unable to fire because
couldn't
you would have been hitting
couldn't
your own
fire.
People.
Right.
I know your story has so many twists and turns, and hopefully people listening are intrigued enough that they'll go online at hometownheroesradio.com and find the links to your book, Letters from the Battlefield in Love and War. But I think we can let them know how that story ended. If you have all these letters in this book and you found them somehow, what happened with that young lady you'd asked to marry?
She was working as a nurse in a hospital without any superiors, so they had to do a lot more work. They were working 12 hours a day, 14 hours a day in the hospital. They were the nurses. When she knew she was going home, I knew that I would be going home relatively shortly. I didn't know when. The war ended. I got there. She wasn't there. She had already gone home. They had released her. So I went back to Brooklyn, and I knew the building she lived in. I knew which train went there because that's where I used to go to all the time.
Yeah.
I told her on the phone that I was coming, and when I got there, I got to the apartment house. I was very impressed by the apartment house. It was the only apartment building I'd ever seen that had an elevator in it. She lived on the ground floor. I never used it, but I was very impressed by the elevator. So I finally went down a long hall. I got to the door of her house. She had been smart enough to tell her mother and father to take a hike for a while. I got to the door. I couldn't wait. Knocked on the door, rang the bell, no answer. Knocked on the door, rang the bell, no answer. Knocked on the door, and suddenly I heard a voice on the other side. She said, yeah, it's me. I said, okay, open the door. No. I said, open the door. No. Why? I can't. It's been too long. I can't. I got so furious. I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to break that door down. I'm going to back up and go charging at the door. And if I get killed trying to break through that door, I heard a click. The door was open, unlocked. And I went in. Out of a clear blue sky, one of her relatives, her older sister, had a husband who was unexpectedly rich. And he decided that he was going to make the marriage for us. And they did it in the basement of his house. They invited about 100 people, all relatives. I had no relatives. I have no sisters, no brothers, no aunts, no uncles, no cousins, nothing. It was just my mother, my grandmother, and me.
Mm-hmm. But all that time that you're overseas, all the times your life could have ended, and again, she'd already said no to you once, but it works out that you come back, you find her again, you marry, you have children and grandchildren, and all these years together. That's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm one of the luckiest guys alive.
Jerry Countess continued to believe that until his passing last year at the age of 99. His book is a fascinating read. I have that linked for you online at hometownheroesradio.com. When we come back, another infantryman who contributed to the liberation of Sicily 78 years ago. And then we'll hear from others who participated in the water, on the beach, and in the air. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down, 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck, 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at providentpayments.com or call that number 800-989-1139.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode focusing on the anniversary of the invasion of Sicily, a six-week operation that began July 9th, 1943. You heard about Brooklyn native Jerry Countess's close call there. Now let's get some perspective from Rex Rainey. Like Countess, he would go on to some significant action after Sicily and, like Jerry, become a recipient of the Purple Heart. He would even help liberate the Dachau concentration camp. But Sicily came before all of that, preparing Rex and so many others for the intense moments to come. In his case, the military journey started before America entered World War II. Rex Rainey joined the National Guard while still in high school in Colorado.
That's a yes and no question. You were well aware of it, but you figured if there's war, you was going to be in it one way or the other anyway. I enjoyed the National Guard.
December 7th of 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you got the news?
I was in Old Mexico. There was five of us having a good weekend. And when we came back across the bridge, the guard told us we'd better get in uniform and get back to camp. Pearl Harbor had been bombed. It had been a pleasant night before in Old Mexico.
What was that like as a young man to hear that news and find out, now this is real?
Well, we was all supposed to be home by Christmas that year because we'd served our year. I had gone into the National Guard as a lineman. That's when we were inducted. Then in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, where we first reported, I became a switchboard operator. When we moved to Abilene, I was made a corporal in charge of the switchboard and the linemen. Then I was made a sergeant in charge of the communications.
Mm-hmm.
That was it at that time.
Were you one of those who was eager to go overseas and get a piece of this, or you were in no hurry whatsoever?
Oh, for some reason, I wasn't in a hurry. We knew it was coming, and I think I wasn't in a hurry because my oldest brother, the day after Pearl Harbor, he went down and joined the Marines and was back in Los Angeles with 56 bullet holes from his waist down while we were stationed at Fort Devens, Massachusetts.
Mm.
And for some reason, I wasn't in a hurry.
I think we're getting a picture of what the reason was. And there were four of you boys.
Yes.
Did all four of you end up in the war?
No. My older brother Vern and I did. And my brother, just younger than I, was born deaf in one ear. Then my baby brother was far too young.
Mm-hmm.
He was still, I think, in grade school. But he served later both in Korea and occupation of Germany.
Wow. So quite a legacy of service in your family. And your brother Vern is the one who's wounded in the Marine Corps.
Yes.
So before you ever ship out, one of your brothers is already back from the war, and clearly his life's going to be a lot different with the injuries he suffered.
Right.
I could see how that would impact you. Before we move on with your story, how did that affect him for the rest of his life?
Well, I don't know how many operations he had. He was still in the hospital when I got back from the service, and I think I'd been home several months before he finally got out of the hospital.
Wow.
Could walk with a cane.
So here's a guy in his early 20s, and he's going to be walking with a cane the rest of his life.
Well, he was determined.
Mm-hmm.
I think he used a cane for 2 or 3 years and insisted life had to be different. Got on with the Forest Service as part of their maintenance crew.
Mm.
And he spent quite a few years building roads, trails, bridges.
So he goes over early, gets wounded with the Marines, and you left for overseas a lot earlier than most of the World War II veterans alive today did. In fact, and a lot of people mistakenly think that's the first time that America made a landing in Europe. That's not the case. You were part of one earlier than that. But the first place you went with the 45th Infantry Division was North Africa?
Yes.
What was that journey like across the ocean? Had you ever been on a ship before?
That's the first ship I'd ever been on.
Uh-huh.
It wouldn't make sense to most people, but it took us 21 days of zigzagging. We saw how the Navy operates when they think there's a submarine in the area. I'd hate to tell you how many barrels we saw shoot off of a sub-destroyer, I guess they call them.
The depth charges to try to get the subs.
Yes.
Because as early as you went over, this is 1943, that U-boat threat in the Atlantic was still significant. There were a lot of Allied ships that were being hit.
That's right. Not all of them made it.
So I imagine that might have been a little nerve-wracking for a young man from Fruta, Colorado.
Well, you got to where you just kind of laid on Navy ship, because what could you do? They were doing all they could to protect you, but the blood did circulate a little.
I imagine. And I know, again, this is a long time ago, but if you can think back to that young man heading overseas and what was on your mind, was this something? I mean, you've already seen your brother get wounded, and you know that he's got a long battle.
Well, I've heard about him.
Right. You haven't seen him yet, but you got the news in the
mail.
Did you think you were going to come back?
Not really.
You'd come to grips with that. The likelihood was?
Well, I didn't think about that. After we'd landed at Iran and got the sea legs gone, and then we invaded Sicily, about our fifth day on Sicily, we'd had casualties before that, but that's the first time we had any KIAs. We got five that day, and it brought things home pretty fast.
Mm.
But we still had no doubts, and Sicily went pretty good. Then after that, we went to a place called Salerno, Italy. That's when you decided you better make the best of every chance you get, because you're not going to the States.
Mm. It was that grim.
When you call on white phosphorus shells to keep from being a KIA or a prisoner, you get a little different perspective on life.
I can imagine. And I know this is not easy to talk about. And before we started, you told me that you've spent a lot of years trying to forget some of the things you experienced. And I don't want to take you anywhere that you don't want to go. And I so appreciate your willingness to help us understand what people like you went through so we have what we have today. What was your job in these landings and these invasions? What were the things that you had to carry out?
This is hard to explain, because when I set foot in Sicily, my commanding officer, Sid Rexure, battalion sergeant major again, I came in on the third wave in Sicily, caught up, and he said, the first thing I want you to do is get a Tommy gun and take my Jeep. And he said, we got about 300 prisoners I want you to take back to the first MP you see. That was my introduction to Sicily.
I guess so. Welcome to the war. So how did that go? How did that unfold?
Real good. I think the reason Sicily went so well, a lot of it, the Germans depended on the Italians to defend, and most of the prisoners were Italians. They were glad to wave the flag and come out. First MP I saw was a second lieutenant in an MP Jeep, so I flagged him down, and he told me I would have to take him back to the beachhead. Having been acquainted with him in Fort Devens, Massachusetts, I had my opinion of him, and I racked back to Tommy, and I said, sign for 300 prisoners, or you don't go further. He told me, he said, I'll have you, and I told him, fine. You tried it at Fort Devens, and you ended up in the MPs, because he was assigned to a line company up there.
Of all the people you had to run into, huh?
Yeah.
So you left the prisoners with him?
He wrote me a receipt for 300 prisoners.
Moving on from there, you mentioned the landing at Salerno, and I was asking you what kind of duties or role you had at that point. Was it different there than it had been at Sicily?
Completely different. Normally, a sergeant major isn't on the line, But before we got off of Salerno, everyone but the cooks took frontline duty.
Mm-hmm.
You all became infantrymen. Cooks were busy doing things you didn't want to do.
Because the casualties were very high.
Lots of men lost their way. Our battalion lost one platoon of Baker Company and a reinforced platoon of Charlie Company, where that some of us called on white phosphorus chemical mortars to stop the German advance on us so we could get out of that area.
At what point do you make that decision? Because the way you're describing it, it sounds like that's kind of a last resort.
Well, you've got some people captured. You got tanks and anti-tracks and half-tracks. They've got machine guns. You know you can't remain in that area. And we had a bank to climb, so you, human chain, you climbed on each other and one got up and then you helped the next. That's when you called on the white phosphorus, when you got on the bank and called so the Germans stopped.
Because if you didn't, you would have been overrun and you would have been captured or killed.
Correct.
How did you handle that? Because, I think of your age. I mean, you're what, 22 years old at the time?
Somewhere in that neighborhood.
Were you scared?
Tell you the truth, the soldier that tells you he was never scared, I wouldn't believe.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a different type of fear. It was I may be going down, but some of you are going with me.
Mm.
Well, that was my mentality. You don't go down without a fight.
And what were you armed with?
At that time, an M1.
One rifle?
Right.
And you already described what some of the opposition was. And are there enemy artillery shells coming in on your position, too?
Those German 88s are just as deadly as an artillery shell. But I think the Germans had crossed over the street from Sicily and were waiting there because they hadn't had full chance to regroup.
At this point, are you starting to come to grips with the death around you? Guys that you trained with or knew or were standing right next to that are getting killed?
You're well aware of it. That's where I decided to get as many as you can, and I guess I wasn't successful because I set my store at 70 Germans before they get me. I'm here, so I must not have got 70.
Well, and I'm sure there were plenty of times where they almost got you, and in one case, you were wounded. You're a recipient of the Purple Heart. We're going to hear about that. But were there some moments where you came really close that really got your attention?
Oh, well, I was on Salerno in defensive position. The tanks and half-tracks were coming down on us, and the report, I don't know for sure, but the report was the tanks were doing a half circle over a foxhole, and German soldiers were bayoneting them.
Mm.
And someone, thank goodness, had some power and called for air support straight from our front lines. The P-38 is not a popular aircraft, I don't think, but it sure earned the respect of a lot of infantrymen because they came in and they went down our line and came back. And something told me to set up in my foxhole in the back of it, and in my foxhole a 50 caliber slug lit. But they knocked out two tanks, and the rest of them and the half tracks all fled. So
mm-hmm. That's why the Germans called that plane the fork-tailed devil, the P-38. So it saved your guys' lives there, those P-38s that came in, but nearly took your life. This is a friendly fire shell from a P-38. That landed how close to you?
Well, I was in the back of a foxhole, and it landed where my head had been. Because some said set up, and so I set up in the back part of the foxhole.
Like, and we're talking about a split-second decision?
Or less, yeah.
If you hadn't moved, your head's disintegrated.
Right.
But you move, it hits right behind you. And you're not wounded at all?
No.
How do you explain that?
the good Lord looks after you.
He would look after him more when he was wounded later on. You can link to the complete original interviews with Rex Rainey and Jerry Countess at hometownheroesradio.com. But when we come back, three more veterans who had a hand in liberating Sicily 78 years ago. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our focus on the anniversary of the invasion of Sicily, an important milestone in the Allied victory in World War II as it paved the way for the liberation of Italy, France, and the rest of Europe. Just about everything you know about D-Day, from beach landings to paratroopers and glider troops behind enemy lines, it was all done on a smaller scale nearly a year earlier in a six-week battle that met with much success, but also cost the lives of more than 2,800 Americans. You've already heard from two men who nearly added to that number, and now you're going to hear from three more. Bill Kendall would go on to have a significant role in the Normandy invasion in 1944, but Sicily would be his baptism by fire. By the time I had the privilege of interviewing Bill, his hearing was almost gone, and his speech not quite as easy to understand as it once was, but as you'll find, his memory and mental acuity still razor sharp.
Well, I went to Norfolk, Virginia, and that's when they put us in the 2nd Beast Battalion. We then shipped out to North Africa, arrived in Oran during an air raid, incidentally. But we wound up in a field where the army was located, and they sent out half a captain to everybody in coveralls. We didn't know what was going on. And we found out we're being trained by the Army. And they did a pretty good job.
And some people listening probably have never heard of the 2nd Beach Battalion, so they may not understand what the role of a beach battalion is. Can you help us understand that bigger picture and also what your role in that unit was?
Well, our role was to land and set up the beaches for the assault troops. And we did that in Sicily and in Normandy.
And you had to establish some radio communications when you landed? Was that your specific role?
We had a little generator that came with us, and we had communications with the ships at sea. Of course, the whole thing was to get ashore and survive.
Yeah, and that was no small feat. And I know this is a long time ago, but you told me your memory is really sharp for those years. So I'm wondering if you remember just that journey over from Norfolk to North Africa. Was there some concern about German submarines or your convoy being attacked?
Well, I think there was some, as I understand, they were attacked. One of the ships was damaged, I understand, in the convoy. So I guess we did pretty good going across without being hit.
And did you have any thought in your mind as you're leaving the only country you've ever known and you're heading overseas, was there a concern in your mind that you might not come back?
No, I don't think so. It might have been, but I don't recall. I know the Army kind of brainwashed me, so you kind of lose the feelingness that goes that I probably had prior to that. So things are a lot different when you're trained, particularly to do a thing. You do it automatically.
What was the first moment where it sank in for you that this is war, and you saw the side of war that includes death and destruction, and it's real?
Yeah, well, I know when we get ready to land in Sicily, we were put on an LST, which has small boats where we all loaded into, and then supposed to drop into the water. Well, the boat that I had me in went to the level of the ship deck and stopped. And the boat kind of swung out from the ship three or four times until someone found the trigger, and it dropped into the water about 10 feet. So, and as we hit, a couple of spotlights came in from the shore. We thought that was maybe the end of it. But they knocked that off, and we landed. And as we hit the beach, the ramp wouldn't go down because it was damaged during the hit against the side of the ship. So I was pretty well covered with it. I had a submachine gun and a lot of ammunition, so I couldn't get over the top like the other guys did. So I finally, the ramp got down about 25 inches maybe, and I squeezed through that. And I was kind of getting stuck in the V of the ship with my foot. Well, the guy put it in reverse, and he threw me off. So I landed in the water about 3 or 4 feet.
This is your first landing, and this is Sicily. You know, we hear all this about D-Day, but not too many people know what you guys did at Sicily, which was a long time earlier. This is 1943. So I'm just trying to understand here. It kind of sounds like a nightmare.
It was a nightmare. When we fell, it left my stomach, and we all threw up because we hit them so hard.
So you're in this landing craft, and you're swinging back and forth, crashing into the side of the ship, and then you finally drop and smack into the water. And so you're saying that jiggles you all up and disorients you?
We're maybe 3 or 4 minutes late getting going because of that. So we were the tail end of the group going in, but we all made it pretty well.
But then you're trying to get out of this boat, and the ramp is stuck. Yeah, and you say they just wedged it down enough where you could squeak through the opening between the ramp and the ship?
Just squeeze through.
And then you said your foot got caught. So then when the boat pulls back, you spill into the water. What did you see when you picked yourself up out of the water? What was going on around you?
Well, there was a lot of gunfire going on. It seems a lot of what they call the bullets you can see being shot at pretty heavily as we're landing, but it seemed to be all above the boat. And when I actually landed, we saw the barbed wire on posts, and in our briefing, it didn't tell us anything about the barbed wire. But I met a couple of guys, and they had Bangalore torpedoes, which gives you about 16 feet of explosives, and they put them through the barbed wire and exploded, and we got away up through the beach. But it was a little hectic at the time, and we all survived. One of our group was shot by, I think he was shot by one of the Army guys. He's the only casualty I remember. It was a struggle to get there, but it was pretty good, and we settled down fairly fast.
I'm just imagining. I mean, you're a pretty young guy at this point.
23 years old, yeah.
You're old in relation to some of the other servicemen, but that's a young man to be going through all these things. How did you handle seeing those things, experiencing those things? Was your heart pounding? How did you respond to that?
I don't know. I think I was so, you know, I always thought, I go back and say, why wasn't I scared? I don't remember being scared. You know, usually you kind of panic when you went into that particular situation, but I didn't. I don't, it was because of the Army training. They took the fear right out of me, I guess. Because I was no brave fella. I was just one of the other guys that made the landing. And I saw a lot of the mayhem out there. We captured a few Italian soldiers and stuff. The part about that particular was they were all complaining that they had relatives in Chicago or New York City. Like I say, I survived it, so I was always called Lucky Billy, so that was part of my luck.
Lucky Billy. Bill Kendall just passed away 3 months ago at the age of 101. He went on to a long career in Hollywood, working on shows I'm sure you saw, like All in the Family and Good Times. Phil Reed also ended up in Southern California, and like Bill Kendall, also took part in the D-Day invasion at Normandy, but in July 1943, he too had a close call in Sicily aboard LCI 35. LCI, of course, stands for Landing Craft Infantry.
It was 158 feet long,
mm-hmm.
20 feet wide, flat bottom.
It's not very big.
No, 158, and we carried 200 troops. It was really loaded when you...
And something tells me it probably didn't handle rough seas all that comfortably.
Yeah. Another deal that happened, we were in Palermo, and we were hauling troops up to the Straits of Messina and going to let them off there. And it was 12 o'clock at night, and I just got off a watch. I just got back down to the cruise quarters, and I heard a bang, and we hit a British cruiser broadside. He said if we would have been half a minute longer, he would have cut us right in half.
Wow.
And then on the way back, they pushed all our bow in, but nothing leaked. And so on the way back to Palermo, we were sitting alongside the ship there, and all of a sudden somebody hollered, there's a mine. And a mine went right by us within 2 feet. You could almost touch that. I can still see those things sticking up.
You could see it from where you were.
You were sitting there.
Wow.
I wouldn't be here today if we would have hit it.
Yeah, you got a couple kids who had never been born. There's a great family photo here on the wall, and I'm sure some of those folks wouldn't be here either.
Yeah, that's right.
You can link to those complete original interviews with Phil Reed and Bill Kendall at hometownheroesradio.com. And you can do the same for Ed Ellington, a decorated fighter pilot who, by the time he left the Mediterranean after the capture of Sicily, had flown 116 combat missions. But the most daring, or perhaps foolhardy, flight he ever took was from Sicily in an aircraft you would not expect an American to be flying. Before we get to that, let's hear about what his missions over Sicily in support of the invasion consisted of.
Most of it was dive bombing, of course, for ground targets. Most of what we did were ground targets. And now, I won't say regularly, because it didn't happen regularly, that the German Air Force would hit us. We pretty well ruined the German Air Force. Our biggest enemy was the ground fire, and they were damn good at that.
So you're flying a P-40 all this time, but we've talked about all the other American planes you had flown at one time or another. And here, when you're in the sky, your nemesis is the Messerschmitt, the ME-109. But you wanted to get in the cockpit of one of those and fly it?
I did.
Why?
Oh, it was the evidence of our enemy, the 109.
Yeah.
And I had to have one.
You just wanted to know what it felt like to be the other guy.
Yeah, well,
in that plane.
I just wanted to see what that airplane was like.
And you actually made that happen?
I made that happen.
Tell me how. How did you get yourself in the cockpit of an ME-109?
Well, I was the operations officer of the squadron, for one thing.
Yep, so you had rank.
Yeah, so the CO was a buddy of mine, so we didn't have any problems there.
So this is July 1943. The 8th Army is in the process of taking Sicily, and one German airfield was captured so quickly that the Luftwaffe didn't have time to destroy those aircraft. So here come a few functioning ME-109s that are left over. And one of them had your name on it, as far as you were concerned.
You know, it was just a quest that I just had to have.
Yeah, you couldn't think about anything else until you got that ME 109.
Got that 109.
Sure.
And then we got that little island. So the first thing I did is get over there with ahead of everybody else, find a 109, lay clay claim to it till I got my crew over there, and they put the thing together, and I flew it out of there.
What was that like? Was it different?
Wonderful. Wonderful. It was just, it felt like you just, a heavy accomplishment as you got this damn one up and you got it and you're flying it. It's a hell of a deal.
You'd never been in the cockpit of one of those before. I have to imagine the controls were different from your American
planes. Oh, yeah. That's right. Everything was different. First place, the throttle was on the right side. Most everything in the cockpit was different. The instruments mostly were similar, different locations. You had to get familiar with it a little bit. It wasn't hard to fly.
How far did you take it?
I brought it into our strip in Sicily, parked in my parking lot.
Again?
Yeah.
These strange planes keep showing up. Maybe this is a dumb question, but while you're flying that German plane with German markings, did you ever think, wait a second, I might be making myself a target here. What if somebody doesn't know it's me?
Well, that happened. I mean, when I got the crew up there to get me ready to fly the airplane, we painted stars on it.
Okay.
But that didn't make it an American airplane. We painted off the German markings. Well, yeah, it fooled people when I came landing in at our base with that damn 109. It was actually stupid because they were ready to shoot it down.
I was going to say, that's what I would have done.
Yeah, they're ready to shoot it down. I tried to minimize it by going up and down the runway a few times and shaking the wings.
So you waved to them, but you couldn't talk to them on the radio because it's a German plane.
No, I couldn't talk to anybody.
Yeah.
And so they were confused about that airplane. It had American markings on it. The guys go rocking the wings down the runway. And so, but they came damn close to shooting it.
Did you discover that later after talking
to them? Oh, yeah. The anti-aircraft was British.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they weren't to be fooled just because the markings were different. They saw that damn 109.
Well, I'm glad that we're sitting here talking.
Me too.
But I realize you missed your chance at history there. You could have been the only pilot in the whole war to be shot down as an American pilot flying a German plane shot down by British anti-aircraft.
I'm sorry. I have to apologize.
No apology necessary, and no decorations for that stunt, of course, but Ed Ellington was awarded the Silver Star and Distinguished Flying Cross, among others. This hour has flown right by, but I hope you have a little more perspective on what happened during the battle for Sicily 78 years ago this week, and more importantly, the kind of people five of those courageous Americans who helped liberate Sicily happened to be. If you'd like to hear more from any of those five, you'll find each one of their original full-length interviews at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.